Jack Christie, stretcher bearer, 36th Ulster Division. I had some happy times in Thiepval Wood for a couple of months, preparing for the 1st of July. Although they were throwing shells over and we had to work, on the whole, life was pleasant. Although you still had moments of what was going to happen next, that did not deter from the time you had with your mates in the dugouts at night. I met German prisoners and I used to feel an overwhelming thing. It almost took my breath away when I saw them in a cage, and I remembered passing a cigarette to one. They looked so unkempt and frightened looking. I felt awful for them. I could have wept for them. People always remember the 36th Ulster Division for the 1st of July at the Battle of the Somme, what we call the Battle of Thiepval. Everything went wrong that day. The original plan was, this was to be an advance and a breakthrough. The plan was that the area was going to be saturated with intense bombardment in front of the trenches with guns of all sorts of calibre. There were guns everywhere and ammunition piled up everywhere with camouflage laid over them. It was to go on for 5 days and nights without stopping, and the generals reckoned the German lines would be reduced to pulp with nobody alive in the lines, and we could go over and just march through. That was the plan. But it did not work out like that. No man's land was protected by rows of barbed wire and men could not get through it. When they went over the top at 7:30 hours, the bombardment lifted. It was so coordinated with watches synchronised, so that the bombardment at a certain time would lift forward so many feet and you would move after it. But it turned out that there were places along the line that the wire had not been cut. And men did get through all the entanglements with wire cutters, but that was a holdup. We were carrying stretchers for hours up and down, for many hours without stopping. We were doing it in our sleep, only half conscious of what was going on.
As you listen to those words, they're being read by members of the Somme Association and the Somme Museum. They were reading the words of some of the veterans that advanced on the German-held positions in the Schwaben redoubt on the first day of the Battle of the Somme, the 1st of July 1916, a date that we keep coming back to on this podcast that I, Terry Wenham, call Tales from the Battlefields. We seem to return to that date. Of course we do. It's the worst day in the history of the British Army and its Commonwealth allies. And hopefully that will remain the case forevermore, because there were nearly 60,000 casualties that day. When we visit the battlefield where the 36th Ulster Division advanced across, now it's impossible to imagine what it was like then. The landscape is exactly the same. The Thiepval Woods, the sloping ground, the sunken road known as Mill Road, and then the Mill Road Cemetery close to where the Schwaben Redoubt was established on the brow of the hill, looking down upon those Irishmen. And this week's podcast I recorded on the same battlefield that these soldiers saw on that summer's day, 110 years ago nearly now. It's always better, if I can, to record my thoughts when I'm actually on the battlefield. You see things you wouldn't necessarily see or think of sitting in an office in England. You've got to be there. And in the next half an hour or so, you're going to hear not just what happened in July of 1916, but what happened when the war came once again to Thiepval in 1940, when the Germans came again to Thiepval. This time it was Hitler's Nazis. What happened to the custodian, the caretaker of the Ulster Tower, that is the centre of so many people's visits when they come here today to find out what happened. We learn about the history of the tower itself, the Ulster Tower, Helen's Tower. And we visit the Connaught Cemetery, where so many of these Ulstermen are now at peace, and look at some of the family inscriptions. And of course, as we've just done, we hear from the soldiers themselves. We hear their words and find out what it was really like.
William Calvert, 11th Royal Irish Rifles. In my company, we're the only four men left after the battle, including me. It was terrible seeing all those young men being slaughtered. Many of my friends died that day. They were falling at my feet. But you couldn't stop. You just had to keep moving. It was terrible. I was wounded by shrapnel, but it wasn't too bad. I was one of the lucky ones. How we weren't all killed is a mystery. I suppose it was just luck, but many weren't so lucky.
One of the most downloaded episodes of Tales from the Battlefields I recorded was a couple of years ago here at Tietvale, the Ulster Memorial Tower, where we met Rocky and Joe. Rocky carries out free tours in the trenches and explains the story of the 36th Ulster Division here at Tietvale on the 1st of July 1916. And as I speak, he's carrying out a tour for the nine people that I'm guiding on Terry's tours this week. He starts at the Ulster Memorial Tower itself, which is close to the German front line that was stormed successfully to a certain extent by the Ulstermen on that first day of the Battle of the Somme. And that memorial tower now stands on the German front line opposite the wood where they advanced from, not far over my right shoulder to where the enormous Tietvale Memorial stands today. The tower itself stands 70 feet tall. It's a lasting tribute to the men of Ulster who gave their lives, not just here, but throughout the First World War. But they are forever associated with the Somme battle sites around here at Tietvale. And it holds the record of being the first official memorial to be erected on the Western Front, when it was dedicated on the 19th of November 1921. The tower itself is a replica of a well-known Ulster landmark called Helen's Tower. On completion of that tower in 1867, it was dedicated by Lord Dufferin to his beloved mother Helen, the Baroness, who was the granddaughter of the playwright Richard Brinsley Sheridan. And it was in the shadow of Helen's Tower that the men of the newly formed Ulster Division, they drilled and trained on the outbreak of the Great War. These were the first volunteers. For many men of the 36th Ulster Division, the distinctive site of Helen's Tower rising above the surrounding countryside was one of their last abiding memories of home before their departure for England and then the Western Front. And so many of these men lie beneath the ground that I'm going to tread in today's podcast, Tales from the Battlefield. Many of them lie beneath the headstones in the Connaught Cemetery that I'm sitting in now, and some of them will be lying beneath the headstones in the Mill Road Cemetery that I can see on the horizon, where I can see contractors from the Commonwealth War Graves Commission tending the grass. When demands grew for the construction of a publicly funded battlefield memorial here at Tietvale in honour of the Ulster's fallen, there was a man called Sir James Craig, who later became Northern Ireland's first Prime Minister, and he was backed by many others, and they proposed at a meeting of subscribers that was held in the Old Town Hall in Belfast in 1919 that the monument should take the form of a prominent Ulster landmark. And the proposal, it struck a chord, and Helen's Tower seemed the ideal choice. Architects chosen for the task was a company called Messrs. Bowden Abbott, who came from London. And the work itself was carried out amid the still battled, ravaged terrain here at Tietvale by a firm called Fenning and Co., who came from Hammersmith. On Saturday, the 19th of November 1921, the memorial was opened by Field Marshal Sir Henry Wilson, Chief of the Imperial General Staff and Ulster's most famous soldier. The principal room inside the tower itself is a 16-foot square memorial chamber, faced throughout in stone with an inscription tablet in marble, and that inscription reads, "This tower is dedicated to the glory of God in grateful memory of the officers, non-commissioned officers and men of the 36th Ulster Division, and of the sons of Ulster in other forces who laid down their lives in the Great War, and of all their comrades in arms who, by divine grace, were spared to testify to their glorious deeds." And around the walls, inscribed in golden letters, are the words, "Helen's Tower, here I stand, dominant over sea and land. Sons, love built me, and I hold Ulster's love in a letter to gold." These words, with only one alteration, had been written on request by a poet, Alfred Lord Tennyson, in 1861, and they were engraved on one of the walls of the original Helen's Tower. And given the circumstances that led to construction of the Ulster Memorial here at Teatvale, the opening words of that final sentence had originally began Mother's Love, but was accordingly changed to Ulster's Love. Seems very appropriate, doesn't it? On every wall there are plaques and tributes from local authorities and organisations throughout Northern Ireland. And then from 1921 up until the early 1970s, the tower had a resident caretaker and served as a focus for the many pilgrimages here to the Somme battlefields. By the late 1980s, the tower had fallen into disrepair, public access was limited, and at that stage there wasn't many people coming out here to visit the battlefields at all. But in 1988, a cross-community group known as the Farset Somme Project began to raise public awareness of the tower and lobbied the government to have the memorial itself refurbished. And that happened in 1989, the 1st of July, of course. The tower was rededicated in the presence of Her Royal Highness Princess Anne, the Duchess of Gloucester, and the Somme Association was founded to manage the tower and enable it to be opened for visitors. And then in 1994, the visitor centre next to the tower was opened and a full-time caretaker appointed. And inside the tower now, the upper portion of it provides accommodation for the Somme Association staff that take it in turns to work here throughout the season. And then in March 2004, the Somme Association purchased Teatvale Wood, which is just behind me. And in July 2006, they opened a small area of the wood, which is now available for guided tours, and which my group are about to enter. And as I say, we did a whole podcast on this with Rocky a couple of years ago, which you'll find in the back catalogue of the podcast. Of course, the wood itself is private property, being owned by the association. It's locked up. You can't go in it without prior permission. Please, if you do come, don't attempt to do so. Just contact the association and they'll arrange a tour for you. And what I've found, what I've got here, is an account of what happened to the tower when war returned here in 1940. It's written by a man called Charles Smith, who came from Newry in County Down, and since January of 1939 he'd been the caretaker of the Ulster Tower. And this article was published in the Belfast Telegraph on the 11th of June 1940, so just after the evacuation of the BEF from Dunkirk. He says, as caretaker of the tower, I was the last to leave the village of Teatvale together with my wife and her sister. Evacuation of the village commenced on Friday, May the 17th. We'd only heard of this late in the evening and decided to pass the night in the tower and to seek some means of getting away tomorrow. The German bombers had days previously been bombing down the town of Albert and our immediate neighbourhood, and only 2 hours previously had dropped bombs on Poisier, 2.5 miles away, killing one woman and wounding several other civilians, setting fire to a petrol lorry and farmhouses. We therefore invited our four friends, together with a French woman left alone on her farm with two very young children, to stay the night in the tower. We considered it to be the safest place we could find. And just as I read that, it seems incredible to think that after all the slaughter and sacrifice that went on here in 1916, this is just 24 years later, once again, the people of the Somme area being subjected to war, the civilians being killed. Saturday the 18th was spent in searching for means of getting away. Where to? Anywhere it was possible to get to, the preference for the coast. Trains, we found, had ceased to run, taxis or any other motor vehicles could not be had at any price, and all farm and horse-drawn vehicles had left, loaded with civilians, crowded on top of whatever belongings the owners had had time to pack. All day, the Germans were bombing and using their machine guns. And by the time we men had finished our search, it was night, and then suddenly we saw the lights of a car approaching the tower. I ran down the drive and stopped the car. I found the driver was a farmer I knew in the village. He'd returned to collect a few last belongings. I explained our plight, and after several pleadings, the ladies finally prevailed on him to take us in his car next morning to St. Paul. Luckily, we had the petrol necessary for the trip, and the six of us packed ourselves into the small car at 4 o'clock on Sunday morning the 19th, whilst the Germans were overhead bombing and machine gunning in the neighbourhood, and the gunfire was plainly nearing from the direction of back home. We set off for Doulon's, taking the secondary roads to escape the crowded main roads, but found these equally congested with every class of vehicle, from large carts to small carts piled with whatever possessions their owners could load on them. We ourselves could only take one small bag, just a change of underclothing, and even at these our driver grumbled, although packed like sardines we were thankful to be on the move, and after 4 hours journey, ordinary it would only take half an hour, we arrived at Doulon's. Morning found us trying all means of getting away from Boulogne, but we heard the Germans had already destroyed all means of communication to the south. Wondering what to do next, an official of the War Graves Commission told us arrangements had been made to send over our wives in a ship due to sail sometime that day. Relieved and thankful, we saw our wives aboard, kissed them goodbye, and reported back to our head office. Here we found there was to be an immediate evacuation of the town, and eventually found ourselves, together with all grades of the War Graves Commission, embarked on the same ship with our wives. We arrived at a south coast port on Wednesday morning the 22nd, and by special train we reached London. I'm now staying with my wife, her sister and husband in Derbyshire. But what of the Petite Belle Tower, the Ulster Tower? Nothing could be taken away from it. I just locked the door and left, my heart heavy. More than one person shed a tear as I closed the gate. I did not want to leave even then. Since the day it was completed, I've admired its beauty of lime. Now, weathered by age and toned to its surroundings, it is more appealing to the eye than ever. Thousands of Ulstermen of all ranks served in the present BEF, and they visited it during the past 7 months and admired its imposing beauty. So he's talking about the men of the BEF that were hopefully eventually evacuated from Dunkirk. This is during that phony war period between 1939 and May of 1940. May they, he says, and also the thousands who visited previously, be spared to return to Tietbel after this dreadful war is over, to find Helen's Tower unharmed, still standing, dominating over sea and land. And it was to be 4 long years, of course, before France was liberated, before people could return to Helen's Tower. And as a postscript, the Belfast Telegraph reported on the 4th of September 1944 that the Ulster Tower was now back in Allied hands, following the sweep north across the old Somme battlefields by units of the British Second Army. And on the 11th of September, the Belfast newsletter published this short article. All it says is this: a correspondent with the British forces in France reports that the memorial to the Ulster Division at Tietbel, a replica of Helen's Tower, is undamaged, but the gardens are neglected. Helen's Tower had survived the Second World War to remember the men of the Ulster Division that fell exactly where I'm standing now in 1916. I'm looking at it now, not as white as it was, it's weathered because of its exposed position, but it's there to tell the story. This account was written by a former soldier from the 36th Ulster Division who came to Tietbel Woods. It's behind me, I don't know whether you can hear the bird song. He came here in July of 1930, so 14 years after he'd served here. And he said, as he entered the wood, I treaded my way through the young trees of Tietbel Wood. All the familiar things had gone. No, not all. There amongst the green foliage of the saplings stood a gaunt, toothpick-like stump. Here at last was an old comrade. With what friendly feelings I lingered before this war-torn veteran. He's talking about this old tree, not a person. How much more beautiful it seemed to me that those fresh young saplings swayed gracefully in the breeze. As I fondly ran my fingers over the shrapnel seared trunk, and the young trees vanish beneath memory's magic wand. Elgin Avenue, Gordon Castle, all the old trenches and dugouts and duckboards reappeared in my mind. I was no longer alone. I was marching step by step in the ranks of the Deathless Legion, in company with my comrades, long since gone west. Where I am now is exactly where he was. I'm looking into the wood. Those young saplings are now mature trees, over 100 years old themselves. I can see the trenches that have been excavated by the Somme Association, where those men advanced from. I can see the birds. It's early spring. The foliage is beginning to return to the trees. Some of the trees have fallen down in the high winds of the last few days, as though they've been hit by a shell. Perhaps another memory of what happened all those years ago. Teepvale Wood ceased to exist after July 1916. It's back now with all its stories, all its memories, all its ghosts, like all of the woods on the Somme. What else can we discover while we're here? Those men, those Ulstermen, they come out of their frontline trenches and crawl into the grass of no man's land, waiting for that whistle to blow. And up they go, up the hill that I'm looking at now, up towards that Shraven Redoubt. And they get there. The nearest thing to hell, one of them said, absolute murder. Some good dugouts there. We were in one half of the Schwaben, and the other half was still German. The shell fire was shocking. The land was 6 feet lumps of clay and chalk and dead with green faces. Unburied dead lay all over Teepvale. I talked to one of the dead who was standing up in a trench, leaning up against the side. I asked him a question. The front of his pocket came away in my hand. And just outside of Teepvale Woods, in what was no man's land, where those Ulstermen crawled out to shorten the area that they'd have to attack, is the Connaught Cemetery. This cemetery was begun in the early autumn of 1916. By the time the armistice arrived, there were just 228 burials here. But it was greatly increased after the armistice, when graves were brought in from the battlefields in the immediate area, and also there were 10 cemeteries that were closed down and the graves exhumed and concentrated, reburied here. The majority, as you'd expect, of the burials here are from officers and men that died in that summer and autumn of 1916. There's now 1,288 Commonwealth servicemen of the First World War buried and commemorated here, and half of them, 642, were unidentified, and we find two special memorials. The men that are believed to be buried here, and five that were buried in one of those former cemeteries who, when they went to concentrate them, exhume them, they couldn't find them. All of the casualties here that are identified come from the United Kingdom. And there's a relatively new burial here. You walk on the road, getting away from the altar tower. There are three graves, which I think date from 2015 from memory. They were found. Yeah, it was 2015. They were found when the road was being widened in readiness for the 2016 centenary of the Battle of the Somme. They widened the road and they found these three men now whose graves I'm looking at. One was from the Cambridge here. Someone has pinned a knitted poppy to it. And next to him is another unknown soldier, but this one from the Royal Irish Rifles, no doubt dating from the 1st of July when they attacked here. And then next to him is one that, he's a man called David Harkness Blakey, who'd been awarded the Military Medal, who died serving with the Royal Inniskilling Fusiliers here on the 1st of July 1916, aged 26. Personal inscription his family chose nearly 100 years after he died, forever loved by his wife and children, remembered always. I think, if I remember right, he was an Englishman, sergeant, but serving with the Royal Inniskilling Fusiliers. Just as we slightly walk around the group, visitors to Teakvale Wood, Rocky has now taken them into the wood, telling them his stories. And there was a few people here earlier, but now there's just me wandering amongst the graves, seeing the odd flag, the odd tribute that people have left, wondering who these men were, the unknown ones. Reading the inscriptions, Private 27692, William Rice, Royal Inniskilling Fusiliers, aged 23. Too dearly loved to be forgotten from his mother. That's the personal family inscription there. Breaks your heart, even though I've been staring at these headstones in this particular cemetery I first came. I remember coming here 25 years ago. Still walk round, still think of these men. 23 years old, that last one. What would he have achieved in his life had he not died here? One of them here has obviously had a visitor from home, Private 3103 W.J. Blatch from the Cambridgeshires, again showing that he died on the 13th of November 1916, and they placed a photograph of him laminated in front of his headstone. Not just, as we can see, July, there's quite a lot from November and October when the fighting continued here. There's another one that's had a visitor, another one from Cambridgeshire Regiment, Sergeant, Lance Sergeant S.J. Stone, Cambridgeshire. Another photo there, 14th of October 1916. So what we're going to do now, what I'm going to do, is walk up as they did, or they ran, through No Man's Land, up to the Mill Road Cemetery. We're going to take just one brigade, and as I walk up the farm track, tell you what happened from a historical point of view. I'm using a book to tell the story from the Pen and Sword Battlefield, Pen and Sword Battleground series. And this one was written by Michael Steadman. And it's the 109th Brigade that we're looking at. It says that their objectives included the Schwaben Redoubt and the Moquet Switch Line, and the Moquet Switch Lines to the immediate east of the Schwaben Redoubt. The redoubt was garrisoned by Bavarian soldiers, and as with all of the 36th Division attacks at 7:30 that morning, the 9th and 10th Royal Inniskilling Fusiliers had crept out across the sunken road, just crossed, and little was left of the German wire. The artillery bombardment had done its job here. Such was the concentration of the smoke, artillery and trench mortar barrage. They were also able to do this in broad daylight just minutes before the assault began. An operations report says, 7:15 a.m. on a beautiful summer morning, the two leading companies began to issue by platoons through the prepared gaps in our wire into No Man's Land and form into extended line with about 3 paces interval, and in this formation crept cautiously up till the leading line was within 100 yards of the German A line, where it lay down to wait the signal for assault. And that's exactly what I'm doing now. I've got a rucksack on my back with a few books in and a drink. I still hear the birdsong. I can see the Ulster Tower over to my left. Over my right shoulder, I can see the Teakvale Memorial. and I can imagine the German positions there, which were to play an important part in that day. At that signal, the speed of their advance upon the German first line was so rapid that few, if any, German machine guns in front of Schwaben were brought into action against them. Hardly a man of the tents was seen to fall at the early stage of as the lines advanced across the tall summit grasses of No Man's Land. The 9th, to the right of the 10th, suffered more casualties from the enfilade fire from at least one machine gun in the Tietwald Fort, which was already trained on the Ulsterman passing north of the village. You can see, as we look across to Tietwald, what a clear view the Germans would have had from there. However, the German front and immediate support trenches were simply overrun by the Ulstermen from Derry and Tyrone, and they drove forward towards the Schwaben redoubt. As they moved forward, all of these men came within range of the Tietwald machine guns, who had effectively repulsed the attacks of the Lancashire Fusiliers and Northumberland Fusiliers on the trenches west and southwest of Tietwald itself. So what we're saying is the Germans up at Tietwald had dealt with the British attackers in their area. So with nothing else to do, they turn their machine guns to the right and they shoot across. What they can see is the Ulstermen attacking their Bavarian comrades here. As the Derry and Tyrone men across the skyline, their right-hand unit, the 9th in this Glen Fusiliers, suffered increasingly heavy casualties from this enfilade fire. Behind them, the men of the 11th in the Skillings and the 14th Royal Irish Rifles suffered terrible casualties as they emerged from the wood in support of the 9th and 10th. And by now, that German machine gun at Tietwald Cemetery was in action since the British barrage had lifted past the beelines. The last remnants of the British smokescreen had cleared and visibility in front of Tietwald was good. It was apparent that that great bowl of land bisected by the Tietwald Road was now bloodied by the ghastly spectacle of hundreds of dead and dying soldiers. But by 8 o'clock a.m. the front face of Schwaben, the German reserve line, was secured by the brigade's assault battalions, and half an hour later these soldiers were through Schwaben into the Mokay switch line, having sent back hundreds of prisoners, many of whom were glad of the chance to outpace their escorts across the terrors of the battlefield and back into Tietwald Wood. In the heat of the battle, these German prisoners stood little chance. Again, the 10th report, 10th Battalion's report, was graphic in its description of what happened to the first clutches of captured men. It says enemy prisoners now began to come in, most of them having evidently been concealed in deep dugouts in the German support line, which runs close behind their front trench. They seemed for the most part dazed and bewildered by the fury of our bombardment and were only too glad to surrender and throw down their arms. They were sent back under escort to our trenches, about 16 prisoners to each escorting soldier. The first batch of these prisoners were so anxious to reach the shelter of our trenches that they outstripped their escort in dash across the open, and meeting our reinforcing lines came forward. Although the 9th Battalion were terribly thin in numbers, they managed to take their objective. I can now hear, I don't know if it's picking it up on the microphone, the bells of Tietwald Church. That tells me that it's midday. It's very cold but dry day here on the Somme. As I approach Mill Road Cemetery, birdsong above my head seems to be getting stronger. The linesman device, the electronic map reading device that I have in my hand, tells me that I'm now right on top of the first German trenches, the A trenches, as the Irishman called them. I'll turn round and look back. I can see the Connaught Cemetery in front of me, over the 1,000 casualties that we've just visited. And then the trees of Tietwald Woods, with the Ulstermen have come out and where the German prisoners have gone back, and sadly some of them have met their grisly end. And over to my right, I see the British Union Jack fluttering in the breeze. On either side of the farm track, the fields have been ploughed and the crops are showing early signs of growth. In amongst, I can see bits of chalk on the surface reminding us of what's beneath the ground and why this area was so good for tunnelling into, which is exactly what the Germans have done here to form that enormous Schwaben Redoubt. Tunnels and dugouts linking all the trenches together, providing a safe haven. It's built in like a almost triangular oval shape, and that would give their machine guns the opportunity to enfilade fire anyone approaching from the sides. But here, the enfilade is being done cheap now. And I see that field of fire that the Germans had. I can see one of many coaches leaving the Tietbau Memorial car park. And we enter a very unusual spot. I say it's close to the Schwaben Redoubt. And inside the shelter, as usual, there's a visitor's book. Lists all the casualties and a little bit of background about this cemetery. They've got over 1,000 burials. You'd normally see a stone of remembrance in addition to the Christian cross of sacrifice. But that was removed here as it was too heavy. Mill Road Cemetery was made in the spring of 1917 after the Germans had withdrawn to the Hindenburg Line. And it allowed the battlefield from the previous summer to be cleared. And at the armistice, there was only 260 burials here. That was greatly enlarged from graves, a bit like Connell Cemetery down the bottom, were brought in from four different cemeteries in the area. There's now 1,304 Commonwealth servicemen of the First World War buried and commemorated here. 815 of them are unidentified. And now the sun has come out. And straight away it feels so much warmer here. And I pause here as I wander around the headstone at one particular grave. Private in the Cheshires, who died on the 14th of October 1916 at the age of 22. And the reason I pause at his grave is because probably about 10 years ago now at least, I brought his family here, and using the linesman trench map device, I took the family to the exact point where his body was found. Commonwealth War Graves Commission Bellary report showed us the location, just 100 yards or so at the back of the Mill Road Cemetery. What happened was, when we got there, we discovered that there was a single poppy growing on that exact trench location, that exact map reference where his body was found after the war. Where George Clifford Sheldon had died attacking the Schwaben Redoubt in October of 1916. And I'll never forget that day. It was a very hot day, and I think it was 89 members of the family, different generations, to come. And there was a relative that was quite elderly himself that was with us. And he was in his 80s, I think, late 70s, early 80s, and he'd been struggling with the really hot, it was over 30 degrees. We wandered around the battlefields. When you get to Mill Road Cemetery, you park at the bottom of the road and walk up the farm track that I've just done. It's quite steep, as Elston have found. But suddenly this old man, this relative of George Clifford Sheldon, discovered that the heat was no longer an issue. No sooner had the vehicle stopped than many of us were in, out he jumped and led the way. He'd been here before, many years ago. He knew where his relative was buried. and he went up the hill just like those Ulstermen had done on the 1st of July. He knew where to find the grave, and he did. He slumped to his knees in front of the grave of his relative, the relative that of course he never met, that he'd heard so much about. Incredibly, George Clifford Sheldon had been with the Cheshires up in Belgium during the famous Christmas truce. It was his battalion that had supposedly taken part in a game of football with the Germans. He'd been there, we visited that site the day before. And this was where George's story ended, but whenever I come to Mill Road, so I've just done, take a photograph, I place my hand on the top of his headstone and I think of that young man. And that visitor came here with us all those years ago. He's no longer with us. He himself has now passed on. But I know his family listened to this podcast, and hopefully they know that I, again, have visited his grave.
Before we go, let's hear a few more words from those Ulstermen that were here on the 1st of July 1916, and their words, as I said, have been spoken by members of the Somme Association.
Hugh James Adams, 16th Royal Irish Rifles, Pioneers.
On the 1st of July, we were not thinking about medals. My officer was Lieutenant Cole, and he and a staff officer came up, and men were lying scattered everywhere, and he said that the squad would be recommended for medals. But he was hardly out of sight when a shell landed about 6 feet away, and it killed the officer in front of me and the fella behind. And it blew my gas helmet off, and the officer's heart was torn out. I don't know who buried them. I left them lying there, and I went back to the wood across the river where they gave me another officer. That was the way it was. It was tough. I could not endure war again. The very thought of it would kill me.
Leslie Bell, 10th Royal Inniskillen Fusiliers, the Derries. It was a bright, warm morning. The sun was up in the sky. The big guns were going off like billy-o. We'd been addressed by one of the big knobs from headquarters, who had told us not to run. We could light our pipes and cigarettes, slope our arms and just walk on. There would be no opposition. I was wounded in the legs and back and lay in the field from 8:30 to 4:00 in the afternoon. To tell you the truth, I thought I would never see my home again. I was lying there amongst the dead and wounded, and your thoughts were far from pleasant. There were a number there who had been blown to pieces. What a waste of life.
William McConnell, 11th Royal Irish Rifles. I remember running forward with some others from my unit. Suddenly, one of the men in front dropped to his knees. It was obvious he'd been hit. Well, the next thing I knew, I had this awful pain in my shoulder. Then I realised I too had been hit. Somehow, I managed to make my way back to our own lines and get medical treatment. It turned out I'd been shot. Then it dawned on me how lucky I had been, unlike hundreds of others that day. It was some time later I learned about my best friend, Gordon Paisley, being killed on that same day. It was a terrible blow to me.
Not far away from where this all happened is probably, to me, one of the most beautiful, secluded cemeteries, on the banks of the River Onck in the village of Ortwil. It's tucked away behind some houses. There's a green Commonwealth War Graves Commission sign pointing in the direction of Ortwil Military Cemetery. But I wonder how many people visit there. But we do on Terry's Tours. We often go there, sometimes late in the afternoon, for one final visit to one notable grave, to hear a very emotional song that I wanted to finish the podcast with this week. Within Ortwil Military Cemetery lies the body of Private William McBride, who was serving in April of 1916 with the 9th Battalion of the Royal Inniskillen Fusiliers when he was killed at the age of 20. This is a couple of months even before the great advance, the big push that we've talked about today. When he died isn't important. Willie was the son of Joseph and Lena McBride from Armagh in Northern Ireland, and they chose these words for his personal inscription: "Greater love hath no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends." And many years ago, there was a singer-songwriter called Eric Bogle, and he wrote this song called "The Green Fields of France." And what I'd like to do is to play that song for you now, in memory of not just Willie McBride, but all of those men from the 36th Ulster Division that were either killed, wounded, went missing, or became prisoners of war on the 1st of July 1916.
Well, how do you do, young Willie McBride? Do you mind if I sit here down by your graveside and rest for a while? Need the warm summer sun. I've been walking all day and I'm nearly done. I see by your gravestone you are only 19 when you joined the great fallen in 1916. I hope you died well, and I hope you died clean. Our young Willie McBride was it slow and obscene. Did he beat the drum slowly? Did he play the fife slowly? Did they sound the death march as they lowered you down? And did the band play the last post and chorus? Did the pipes play the flowers of the forest? Did you leave a wife or a sweetheart behind? In some faithful heart is your memory enshrined. Although you died back in 1916, in that faithful heart are you forever 19? Or are you a stranger without even a name, enclosed and forever behind the glass frame, in an old photograph torn, battered and stained, and faded to yellow in brown leather frame? Did he beat the drum slowly? Did he play the fife slowly? Did I sound the death march as he lowered you down? Did the band play the last post and chorus? And did the pipes play the flowers of the forest? The sun, now it shines on the green fields of France. There's a warm summer breeze that makes the red poppies dance. And look how the sun shines from under the clouds. There's no gas, no barbed wire, there's no gunfiring now. But here in this graveyard, it's still no man's land. The countless white crosses stand mute in the sand. To man's blind indifference to his fellow man, to a whole generation that were butchered and damned. Did he beat the drum slowly? Did he play the fife slowly? Did they sound the death march as he lowered you down? And did the band play the last post and chorus? Did the pipes play the flowers of the fall? A young Willie McBride, I can't help wonder why.
to those that lie here. No, why did they die? And did they believe when they answered the call? Did they really believe that this war would end war? Well, the sorrow, the suffering, the glory, the pain, the killing and dying were all done in vain. For young Willie McBride, it all happened again and again and again and again and again. Did they beat the drum slowly? Did they play the five lonely divine sound? The death march as it lowered you down. Did the band play the last post and chorus? Did the pipes play the flowers of the forest? Did they beat the drum slowly? Did they play the five slowly? Did they sound the death march as it lowered you down? Did the band play the last post and chorus? Did the pipes play the flowers of the forest?